Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, to the listener. I'm your host today, Jim Werbel, and today's show is partially an extension of last week's show. Last week, I talked to Mike Easton about Cornerstone Church's outreach and missionary activities in Ames. Originally, this was to be paired with an interview I had with Gary Guthrie, who did missionary work in South America. For numerous reasons, I had to change my plans. I know missionary work is an unusual topic, especially for someone of Jewish background, as I said last time. But it all started when we were having a production meeting, and I saw some Mormon missionaries walking past the studio. To make a long story short, they're not on the show, but I did get hold of Gary Guthrie, and he'll be talking about his experiences. We also have Gail Seiler as a co-host, who will be introducing a parent and community member, Karen Sorensen, and she'll be talking to professor at ISU in human sciences, Susan Arendt, and she'll be talking about a change, people trying to change school lunch practices for the Boone School District. So sit back, keep your ears open for an informative show. To start the show, I have Gary Guthrie. I met Gary Guthrie through his CSA that he operated many years ago. I learned that he did missionary work in South America, so I asked him to speak about those experiences. As with my interview last week, you'll hear numerous mentions of building relationships and community. So let's listen to the interview, which I have broken into two parts. Let's listen to part one. I'd like to welcome a very dear friend of mine, Gary Guthrie, to the show. He'll be talking about his missionary experiences in South America. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thanks, Jim.
What is your religious background, Gary?
My religious background is Catholic, and grew up in the Roman Catholic Church, but I had always wanted to work overseas, thought I was going to be a priest, and did not choose that path. Actually, I was a missionary priest, but did not choose that path. And in the early 80s, there weren't a lot of opportunities for lay Catholics to work overseas. And so one thing led to another, and I ended up with the Mennonite Central Committee in Bolivia.
So Catholic working for a Mennonite missionary, interesting. How did that happen?
Oh, that's a long story. I actually knew some friends, some Mennonite friends here on campus, and I was working for Iowa State in corn breeding. And they encouraged me when the door to working overseas with the Catholics closed, they really encouraged me to consider a Mennonite Central Committee, or known as MCC. Mm-hmm. And the Mennonite Church has its roots in the Anabaptist movement shortly after the Reformation. And it's called Anabaptist because they were rebaptized. The Amish eventually came out of that movement, but they were named after Menno Simons, who was a Dutch priest and did quite a bit of their early writing at the time. But they're a historic peace church. They don't believe in going to war, and some would say even not even paying for taxes. Their origins, as far as the MCC was concerned, was relief work to Mennonites after the Russian Revolution in Russia. So all these Anabaptists got together and started a relief organization for that particular need to help their own brethren and sisters in southern Russia. Eventually, it became a permanent non-governmental organization called MCC.
Missionary work has been an attraction during your life earlier. What was the calling all about, do you think?
My father was an entomologist corn breeder, and he always had a lot of foreign grad students. He was compassionate working with and the patience of working with graduate students from other countries, as well as scientists. We had many, many people coming into our home growing up from all over the world, and that always piqued my interest.
But missionary work is more than traveling abroad, a lot more than traveling abroad.
Well, I grew up during post-Vatican II, and that really shaped my worldview as far as reaching out to the poor and working with the poor. And I took that quite literally of going overseas to do that. Part of my father's passion for helping the farmers grow more food is the one gift that he kind of gave me. And instead of doing that in research and science, I did it with actual direct help with people.
You did agricultural work in South America, in Bolivia?
Yes, I did. And I was introduced somewhat to sustainable agriculture. I had to travel, I don't know how many miles, 10,000, 8,000 miles to go to Bolivia. But in the early 70s and mid-70s, the whole concern about the cutting down of rainforest was quite prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And in Bolivia, in the eastern lowlands of Bolivia, it was semi-humid tropical rainforest.
That's, for the listener, that's in the Amazon River Valley. That part of it, Bolivia, yes, is in the, yes, Amazon River Valley.
And farmers, people from the highlands of Bolivia, where there wasn't enough land to farm, were migrating to the lowlands to farm. And they were continually cutting down, again, the rainforest in order to farm, to grow lowland rice, dryland rice, corn, and having some cattle, whatever they need to do to feed their families. And our organization partnered with other Bolivian organizations, Bolivia Heifer Project, and to try to look for sustainable systems within that context so that the farmers wouldn't have to continue cutting down rainforests.
So what did you know about growing crops in Bolivia coming from Iowa?
I would like to tell you a story that was quite significant for me, and fortunately it happened early on in my tenure. I was given some advice at an orientation by a man who was a professor at University of Florida, Hugh Popano, the only guy I remember during that whole seminar. But he said, if you're lucky, you won't do too much harm. And that stuck with me. That was always in the background of my mind. It's like, don't do too much harm when I go in and to work with people. This was all new to me. It was rainforests, and I lived in a mud house with a tin roof, and the community had to build the house for us. We provided the material, and then they built the house with mud walls. And so I came into the community on a truck with all of our too much gear. But we crossed this bridge over this small stream, and most of the bridges there were just two logs for each wheel track.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was like kind of solid round logs across this small stream. We went in, and then I had to go down to our neighboring village to borrow a horse from another volunteer's community. And I had loaded this thing up with water and all kinds of supplies, this poor little horse. Think large pony.
All right.
And I've worked with horses. I knew better, but it's a new situation. It was hot. The only path I knew was that road, and I didn't figure out how to go down into that stream and back up. And I encouraged this horse to walk on this bridge, and halfway across, its front legs went down.
Oh, no.
And then it lunged back up, rolled over, and went into the stream. I was afraid the horse had broken its legs, and it couldn't get out. And I humbly had to go find some Bolivians and ask for help. And my Spanish was not very good. And I kept thinking to myself, I wonder what they're thinking. This guy is here to help us? That I had a lot to learn as far as what it meant to live in the context of this rainforest. And I think eventually, over time, building friendships was the most crucial thing, because I knew that I did not have all the answers. But through friendships, maybe I could share something. I have certainly learned a lot from them. And maybe over time, maybe there's something that I might be able to provide for them that would make a difference. And the main thing that did make a difference in their lives eventually was Heifer Project International in that community.
Explain to me what you did with the Heifer Project then. Well, to begin, I think some of the listeners know what the Heifer Project is. Some do not. Explain to everyone what the Heifer Project is all about.
So in that context, farmers had to form a committee, and then they had to plant improved pasture for their cows. So it was about a hectare or 2.5 acres approximately. And that took a while to do that. I brought in a lot of seed as well as other pastures that farmers could plant. And so that took a while to do. You know, it took a couple of years. But a few farmers were willing to take that risk and start planting pasture. And then before I left, I was able to bring in a 3-year term. I was able to bring in the first heifer. Well, and this heifer...
Explain what the Heifer Project does in terms of giving animals.
So the farmers don't have to pay any money for this heifer. They get a heifer, and then eventually they bring in a bull to breed. And the first female offspring of that heifer they give to someone else. So there's like a multiplying effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then the farmers eventually own the bull as kind of a cooperative. But then they have – it's kind of a mixed breed of improved – ours was Brown Swiss with local blood for improved resistance to diseases,
mm-hmm.
as well as improved milk production. And this way, this provides protein for the family, which was – they suffered from protein deficiency,
mm-hmm.
and an economic stability. So eventually, if they needed to sell a cow for health reasons, if a family member had health problems, then they could do that.
Your missionary work was really economic development. Doesn't sound very missionary.
It was called – you might call it friendship evangelism in the sense of it was – which is very interesting in this community because there was no organized religion in this community. And
you would think Bolivia, everyone assumes they're all Catholics.
Right, right, but not necessarily. And these were Quechua-speaking people, so they would have some of their own native indigenous culture.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for 3 years. No organized religion. It was a very unified community. They had to have – they were organized around what they called sindicato, or they would have community meetings every month, and they would make decisions by consensus.
Hmm.
And some of those meetings would last all night long. But – everyone was satisfied when that community left, and they were known for being a unified community. When I left, organized religion, both evangelicals and Catholic, moved into the area, and it destroyed the whole community as far as the unity that had, because there was a lot of hatred and competition between the evangelicals and Catholics in Bolivia at the time. And that was just very, very sad to me because I think it destroyed the genuine spirit of cooperation and working together that had been there for during my 3 years. And I think the other thing that I did in the early years was well drilling by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so because they were just drinking out of the streams, so any kind of wells for cleaner, healthier water had a direct impact on their health.
What's the difference between what you did and what some people in the Peace Corps might do?
Good question. We often, when people want to know what MCC is, we say it's a Christian Peace Corps. And at least from my perspective, it's like it's just meeting people where they're at and developing those friendships. And if there's a faith base, then you – I mean, we worked with Catholics. We worked with evangelicals depending upon what was happening in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, there was no organized religion in that setting. In El Salvador, where my wife and I eventually went, that was a different dynamics. And I think these experiences – you know, I'm Catholic, but I worked with the Mennonites – really changed me fundamentally as far as being able to appreciate the good and the bad of faith experiences and to be able to see that in a different light than I might have in earlier years just because of...
Explain that better. What does it do? What has it done for your faith?
I'm very ecumenically minded and that God's Spirit... When I left for Bolivia, I heard a little voice, kind of thought to myself one day when I came back from Mass, and I don't know where this came from, but there was this thought. I go, gosh, I think God is bigger than the Catholic Church. I wonder what that means. That wasn't my experience,
mm-hmm.
but I kind of wondered about that. And all of a sudden, these doors to MCC started opening up, and I followed that path and discovered that God and my experience of God and the Holy Spirit working is so much bigger than any one faith. MCC often said, when you go into community, if you can, just don't do anything except for listen for 6 months to a year to really listen. Now, that's very difficult to do when you're a 27-year-old
mm-hmm.
and you want to be productive.
You want to change the world.
Right, right. But that was very, very good advice at the time. And that's true for when we came back to the States and entered in new communities of trying to listen and pay attention to what was really happening, whatever church community or whatever community you're in.
Thank you.
We have been listening to an extended interview with Gary Guthrie, who talked about his missionary work in South America. We continue with part two of the interview, and he begins to talk about how he took his foreign work as a missionary into spiritual pursuits in Iowa.
You used a term, the Holy Spirit, and in a very positive way. Some of us, everyone has their own stereotype of what that word means exactly. What does the word Holy Spirit mean to you in light of your experiences in South America?
I would say it's God's loving action that creates healing and peace and not division and violence. So anything that works is a positive life force, whether you want to call it Christian, Muslim, whatever it might be, that if it creates unity and positive outcomes for people, that's good action. It's loving action.
You still have that as a foundation in your daily life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If I have one principle, and I didn't learn this back in Bolivia, but or El Salvador, although St. Ignatius talks about the magis, the more. And making all decisions, he would say, always follow the more, whatever gives you more life. And it takes a lot of discernment to do that. But I was really fortunate because I had a gut-level sense of what was more for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to follow that in Bolivia and eventually in El Salvador and subsequently in my life as a farmer. And I think that magis, the more, is the working of the Spirit in that sense. But I learned a lot in El Salvador working with Christian-based communities.
Mm-hmm.
I met people who were willing to die for their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And under very difficult circumstances. And I think when you meet people who really practice what they believe in, it gives you hope and encourages me to continue making positive changes in this world that we live in.
Explain your work in El Salvador more.
My wife and I, we got married in 86, and then went to El Salvador as a married couple,
mm-hmm.
which was created
You're
unique.
You're both fluent in Spanish by then.
Yeah, by then, more or less.
Who was this with?
Also with MCC.
Okay.
And so we were there as doing really relief work. We were working with displaced farmers
mm-hmm.
that were displaced because of war action.
Mm-hmm.
And near Guasapa Mountain, which is only a stone's throw from San Salvador, the capital. But it was a free fire conflictive zone.
Mm-hmm.
And MCC went in there in the early years for relief, for housing and clothing and food.
This was similar to what they did in Russia.
Yes, exactly. And they've always been known for their relief work. And they started a fertilizer loan program so that farmers, if they could find land to farm, they could grow their own corn and beans to at least feed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most difficult thing for people living in war is that they don't feel like they have any choices whatsoever. It's very chaos. And if they can at least grow their own food, that gives them an option of at least some
mm-hmm.
Sense of dignity. And so we administered, it was a revolving loan fund of fertilizer loans for the farmers there in El Salvador. So it was less of development work, but more of accompaniment work of just walking with people in their daily lives.
You probably saw lots of real scarred individuals from being in a war zone. Some deal well with it. Some really get scarred by it.
That's exactly right.
Did you do anything specific to help those families?
More than anything, it was to go visit them in their homes,
mm-hmm.
no matter where it was, even if it put our lives in danger at times. But we were willing to go out and visit them in their own homes and affirm them for who they are. There's this dynamic in the world where farmers are looked down upon as just dirt and uneducated. And I think that's true almost anywhere in the world.
Even in the U.S.
Even in the U.S. And I have come to understand that one of my principal roles, whether it be in Bolivia or Salvador or anywhere I go, and now as a farmer I have more cred,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, is to affirm their lives, that there's nothing better in the world than to be a farmer and growing food for their own families and for their community.
You've told me some of your earlier life stories in our personal friendship. these experiences have really transformed you, I sense, because you were probably just your typical middle-class American kid at ISU, interested in all sorts of things that American middle-class kids are interested. With some deeper interest, but you're a very different person now.
My opinion is that when you encounter another, and I think this relates to Pope Francis. I don't necessarily want to talk about this a lot, but he talks about the culture of encounter. And in the base communities in El Salvador and in Latin America, the liberation theologians really touched my life. It's about freeing people to meet the basic needs of the people. And Pope Francis wants a culture of encounter. When you encounter another, there's that opportunity for transformation and conversion. Not their conversion, my conversion. And that's what I needed.
Conversion to what?
Conversion to a deeper semblance of peace and love. To get out of my own ego.
Which is, you think, the embodiment of Christianity and Catholicism.
Exactly, when it's done the best. And I think if we go to Latin America, it's not because of their needs per se, quote unquote needs. We need them as much as they need us, you might want to say, because of their ability to live life in a different way than us in consumeristic North America. And so those encounters deeply touched my life. When a Bolivian farmer who listens to the radio a lot, one day we had this conversation and he goes, "Is it true that a bomb costs a couple $1 million?" And I go, "Yep." And he says, "I'm lucky if I can even buy a new pair of clothing and shoes for each of my two children once a year." So that reality deeply challenges my own reality. And I think of them all the time. And in fact, when I started farming on my parents' land for just on the 2 acres, I do almost everything by hand, in part because that's my one small way of being in solidarity with all the majority of the world's farmers around the world that do everything by hand. And in Bolivia one time, I had these improved chicken breed that I wanted to give away. And so I had this little bet with this 7-year-old, maybe 8-year-old son of a friend, and I went out to harvest rice with them. And this is all by hand. And so maybe we measured how much rice I could harvest in an hour. And I knew I was going to lose big time, but it just made their lives. It was just so funny to see this kid laughing. But it's like real encounter, being out there with them, sharing that work. My sisters told me after writing letters and whatnot, they said, "Perhaps your role there is one of comic relief." And I love that because actually that was true. It changed these gringos were different enough that it just made their mundane lives maybe a little bit more interesting and different. And I played soccer with them both in Bolivia and El Salvador. So I was willing to mix it up with the people and just be with them. And I think that was one of the best things that I'd ever did. And in El Salvador, it saved my skin several times because I was known as the gringo goalie. And I had people speak up for me on a bus when the military stopped it. And everybody knew, they maybe didn't know me personally, but they knew who I was. And if I hadn't done that, they wouldn't know me or my work.
You work with practical farmers, do you not? And you're trying to get people who are not doing alternative agricultural practices in the United States to consider different agricultural practices. That's what PFI does. Is that a missionary work as well?
It's an extension of everything I've done in my life. I've been really fortunate because it's community development, it's agricultural development. And one of the things about PFI that I appreciate, and this stems from the Maji, so to speak, I really believe the people who are interested in sustainability, there's a life force there, whatever you want to call it. And the Center for Action and Contemplation out in New Mexico has a motto. It's very Franciscan. You counter the bad by practicing the good. And when I came back from overseas, we worked for the Iowa Peace Network for 6 years, my wife and I. We did a lot of speaking engagements all over the state. And yet I was always looking for community and a community of people who could critically think. Mm-hmm. We didn't find that very often. Salvadorans in particular were very acute thinkers because of the war. It forces you to be critically aware of what's going on in their environment. Here in the States, we didn't find that very much. But my first PFI meeting that I went to conference, I thought, oh my goodness, here's a group of people who could critically think. They understood their reality, and yet they were trying to do positive changes within their own farming systems that would make a difference. And they were very cooperative. I mean, sharing information. And that culture, it's not competitive, it's cooperative. And I found my community, really, agriculturally speaking anyway, through PFI. So, and that doesn't happen in church very often. Critically think about Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in a literal translation of Scripture. Mm-hmm. And so I found that to be very, very helpful.
I think one thing that comes out of the conversation, and it should be transparent to the listener, is that your personal life work, which is helping people transform in ways that they'd like to be transformed, comes from a very deep spiritual conviction. Is that accurate?
That would be very accurate. That I want my inward actions to be represented in my outward actions, that it's all integrated into one. And it's a work in progress, obviously. But I try to practice what I believe in as best as I can.
I've been talking to Gary Guthrie, who used to run a CSA outside of Nevada and has done missionary work with the Mennonites. Former Catholic, or
still Catholic,
still Catholic, who's still Catholic.
I like drinking,
practicing
from,
Catholic.
The way I like to say it for my wife and I, it's the one stream, but we enjoy drinking from different wells, and we found that to be for us very enriching. Sometimes challenging, but very enriching to be open to that.
And it's not life. And Nancy is what faith?
She grew up United Methodist, or Evangelical United Brethren, which joined the Methodist Church, and then became Mennonite when she went to Goshen College in northern Indiana.
Thank you for sharing parts of your life story and sharing your passion about your faith with me today.
You're very welcome, Jim. It's been my pleasure.
In case you've turned in late, you've just been listening to an extended interview with Gary Guthrie, a farmer from Nevada, talking about his missionary life both in Iowa and in South America. If you joined us late and would like to listen to the full interview, you can go to our website, khoifm.org, and it'll be there on the first page for a time being on the website. So, I'd like to welcome you to Local Talk 89.1 FM on KHOI Radio, serving Ames and Story City. I'm your host today, Jim Werbel. Next, we have an interview that was done by Gail Seiler regarding efforts to change the school lunch program in Boone. I will let her introduce the guests.
School districts across the country have been dealing with the question of what to do with students whose school meal accounts fall into deficit. This is not students who qualify for free lunch programs, but instead it refers to students who pay for their meals at school but run out of money in their accounts. The issue has even been in the national news lately. For example, cafeteria workers in Colorado and Idaho were reportedly fired for giving meals to students who did not have adequate funds in their lunch accounts. This issue made me think back to my first teaching job in a small town in Montana in the 80s. Each day, the kitchen staff cooked a wonderful homemade meal, and there was no question of who was going to eat. Everyone ate. All students and teachers ate together, and it was a great community-building time as well. But back to the present situation. Many school districts now have policies that when student lunch accounts fall below a certain amount, the students are provided with an alternative meal, often a sack lunch consisting of cheese or a PBJ sandwich and milk. Locally, there are a variety of policies in place. For example, in Colo, students below negative $50 get an alternative meal, but then no meal when their balances reach minus $80. But others, like Ames and Cedar Rapids, provide an alternative lunch only at the elementary level once the account is delinquent $25 or more. Most schools send reminders to parents by email, make phone calls, and in some cases send certified letters. This year, Boone Community School District changed their policy for delinquent accounts. In the past, they followed the policy outlined above, giving students an alternative lunch when their balance was negative. But over the summer, the board voted to change that policy, citing financial reasons. Now they have a cutoff of negative $25. When students' lunch accounts fall to $25 in the red, they are not served any food unless they can pay for it. This policy is in place in both the middle and high schools in Boone. I contacted the superintendent of schools in Boone, Dr. Brad Menard, who supplied the following information in an email. He said that in the previous year, Boone Community School District had 301 families with delinquent accounts totaling just over $10,000. He also said that parents are notified of negative balances in a variety of ways. While the superintendent in Boone was focused on financial reasons behind this new policy, others in Boone see it differently. Some in Boone have reacted strongly to this change and have expressed their concern that some children are not receiving meals while in school, are hungry, and not learning during the school day. These teachers and parents have been working, first, to ask the board to change the policy, second, to ameliorate the impact of the policy on middle school students, and third, to publicize the existence of similar policies in other school districts, hoping for a widespread change in this practice. For this report, I spoke with teachers in Boone, and we'll hear now from Karen Sorensen, a parent and Boone community member who has been active in calling attention to this issue.
The new policy passed for the 2015-2016 school year at Boone Community School District is a policy that does not feed students grades 5 through 12 an alternate meal when their lunch account reaches a deficit of $25.
So in the past, they would continue to serve the regular lunch to students even if their balance was below $25. Is that right?
They served an alternate meal.
They served an alternate meal. And now when students get to that negative $25, they don't get any lunch.
They don't get any lunch.
What have you and others in Boone done to respond to the change in the policy?
Teachers have initiated the move to change the policy. The teachers know that if children don't eat, they can't learn. So one teacher started a lunch fund to pay for lunches, which many teachers have been contributing to. But they also approached the board and urged them to change the policy.
The teachers themselves did.
At that point, the board chose not to change the policy. They did implement some procedural changes to make phone calls to parents with delinquent accounts, which is an important step because in the past, not as many efforts were being made to address students not being fed when they had delinquent accounts. When the board chose not to make any changes to the actual policy, I started a crowdfunding source to supplement the effort of teachers providing funds for students with delinquent accounts and to help raise awareness to the community.
And you did that personally. You're a parent of students in the school system.
I have a student at Boone Middle School.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you did that as a concerned parent.
Correct.
And could you explain how that works? Our listener might not know what crowdsourcing is.
I used a generosity site through Indiegogo, and it's just a free site for humanitarian efforts. I'm just able to put this story on there and a video and just requesting people to make donations if they can, to call on the board members and the state of Iowa and the USDA to encourage policy change. And just to raise that awareness, today I was able to deliver the first check to the middle school of over $1,000 to help supplement that. So it's not a permanent change. It's just It's just to help relieve some of the efforts of the teachers right now.
So that $1,000 will go into student accounts who are below the minimum and so not able to get lunch?
What they've done in the middle school, this doesn't address the high school at all. I don't know if there's any efforts there right now.
Right.
At the middle school, they've set up a specific donation fund account. And so if a child goes through the line and then their card is swiped and there's no money there, then they just enter the donation fund account and the money comes from there. That was set up when this teacher originally started donating money. They set that up so that any teacher could donate into that fund. And it works well because when this happens, there tends to be shaming of the children because they pay at the end. They walk through the line, they get their meal, and then at the end, what's happening is when their card was being swiped, their lunches were beat.
Their lunches would be taken from them in public. They were standing in line. Mm-hmm. And would they just throw that food away then?
Then legally that food has to be thrown away because of...
Right. It's already been given to someone.
Touched, yes.
So the food would be wasted and they weren't given anything to eat.
Correct.
So the teachers were instrumental in getting that set up. And then you've, on top of that, started this crowdsourcing page to be able to supplement that even further with additional money over time.
Right. And to increase awareness outside of the school so people could maybe encourage change, since the initial reaction of the board was to not change the policy.
And so the thing that the board has done in response to the concerns that have been raised is they made some policy change, some changes in being or a little more diligent in notifying parents of their decreasing balance. And
yes.
The reason the board gives for having made this change is financial, from what I've read.
Yes.
So what changes would you want, you and others who have expressed concern about this, want the school board to make?
I don't really have any magic answers for that. And ultimately, I think it needs to change at the national level. But the policy needs to be changed in Boone. And it needs to be a policy where no child is embarrassed in front of their peers by having food taken away, and a policy that feeds every student. When we deny students the basic need of food, we are sending them a message that devalues them as humans. Ultimately, I hope to see the district actively seeking a creative solution to this serious concern. One example is the community eligibility provision, which is a federally funded provision from Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. It allows schools and local educational agencies with high poverty rates to provide free breakfast and lunch to all students. The percentage of Boone Middle School students on free and reduced lunch assistance is currently 37.6%, according to information I received online. And if we had 2.4% more students on free reduced lunch, we would qualify for that program.
So it needs to be 40%, and then the school can give free meals to all students.
Right. And I'm not saying that's the answer. I'm just saying there's options out there, and we can't just say, well, it's the law, and then be done with it.
So this affects students, this change in policy does not affect students who are on the free meals. They are still qualified for free meals and get their free meals. It's for students who don't qualify for that and are having to either pay for part of their meal or pay for the full meal. Is that correct?
That's correct. I guess I don't even know. I guess I can't answer as far as free and reduced lunch. I'm not sure exactly all. If they're on a reduced fee and they're not paying and they still reach 25, it's possible that they aren't fed either. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
So I can't speak on that. But it's kind of the other kids who fall through the gap. They don't qualify for free and reduced lunch, or they haven't been put on that program, and their parents aren't paying for whatever reason, and then they're paying the consequences for that.
Mm-hmm. And this is happening at the middle school. The high school, did the change impact the elementary school as well?
No, the elementary is not. They do receive some type of alternative meal at the elementary. This is just for 5 through 12.
Mm-hmm. Is this what they do at other schools in the area, do you know, or do other schools handle it differently?
That's a great question, and it's actually kind of hard to find the information, you know, as far as what everyone's doing. I know that many still offer an alternative lunch, either free or at cost, and that's just according to the different news stories I've seen where it's been brought attention to in the media, which is why I was aware that it was a national concern. I think there are reasons why it's more harsh in Boone, and the first being that children aren't offered any sort of alternative meal. If their account reaches that $25 deficit, they just don't get fed. And also the age at which it starts. You know, we stop feeding children alternate meals when they reach that deficit as early as age 10, which in many areas is still considered elementary level. So they wouldn't be a part of this policy in other areas. And also, like I talked about, the lunch setup, you know, with the lunch option, you fill your tray and then you pay at the end. So then if your food's taken away, all your peers are there watching.
Right. And an individual child isn't monitoring their parents' account. So they may not even be aware that they're in that great deficit and going to be denied their lunch.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. With the current policy, there is no system in place to prevent students from going without lunch. The children are being held responsible for their family finances.
So Boone teachers and other community members like you have become active in publicizing this and active in creating some options and actually funding lunches for students who would otherwise be deprived of lunches. We haven't heard of other school districts doing that. Do you have any thoughts on what it is about Boone? Why is Boone responding to this so strongly and with such activist approaches?
We only have locus of control over our own community. And so it's important that we stand up for the kid next door, the kid across town, the kid in the apartments. It behooves all of us to become aware of this policy and how it impacts our local community. So I believe we have no choice but to speak out and say that this is not right and this needs to change. And also I think people are unaware in their own communities of the policy and really how it truly impacts students. And so many times the focus is on the parents not paying and the focus is on the money and the focus needs to be on the children because they're the ones who are suffering and they're the ones who, if they're not being fed, they can't learn. I mean, that's their basic need. It's not being met. You know, I think it's really about awareness and people just not knowing the policies.
Do you feel that you've received adequate responses and explanations from the board?
No, I don't feel that we have. The focus should be on students and how to provide the best education for them, and that has not been a focus in their responses. The explanations received from the board and the administration focus on parents not paying and how legally the school lunch program can't run in the red. I don't feel that that's an adequate explanation. It is not okay to say that legally we don't have to provide student lunches to kids and then leave it at that. If a student isn't eating and the family isn't supporting that student, then the district needs to have systems in place to make sure the student is fed. Some things go beyond laws and into the realm of compassion and doing the right thing.
You have one child in the middle school, and you've heard of specific instances where children have been denied lunch or maybe not even going to lunch because
they know
they're going to be denied lunch.
Yes.
So there have been specific cases like that.
Yes. Thank you for taking the time to listen and for giving voice to this concern. I started this because I wanted to give a voice to these students who really can't learn if they're not being fed. Hopefully it'll be one piece of a big network of stories that create change at a bigger level.
Well, thank you very much for telling us about the problem, the concern, and the very important work that you're doing to call attention to it, and the teachers there are doing to respond to it. That was Karin Sorensen, a parent in Boone expressing her dismay about the new policy that withholds meals from students with deficit lunch accounts below negative $25. Stories of students having their lunches thrown away, as she described, because of delinquent lunch accounts are becoming fairly common, so it's not just in Boone. But Karen challenges us to think about a more compassionate way to handle those situations. There is a great deal of research that shows that hungry children struggle to concentrate in class, make more visits to the school nurse with headaches and stomach aches, and may act out because of their hunger. To gain a better understanding of the impact of these lunch account policies and the reasons behind them, I spoke with Dr. Susan Arendt, Associate Professor in the College of Human Sciences at Iowa State University. Many schools now are instituting policies where they're putting some cutoff beyond which, when it goes so much in the red, students no longer are able to get the school meal. Can you talk about the reasons behind that policy shift?
Well, I think the overall reason is fiscal accountability, holding food service operations fiscally accountable for their expenses as well as their revenues. It was the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act in 2010 that changed the requirements of what meals needed to offer, school meals needed to offer. And so in regards to deficits and fiscal responsibility of programs, there's been no per se rule, but these changes have required school food service operations to be very careful in revenue and expenses because some of these foods now that they're buying to meet that requirement may cost more, or they may need more labor to do that. So they're spending more money potentially in labor hours.
And what does research in general tell us about the relationship between nourishment and functioning and learning in school?
Well, I think the research is very clear that for students to be able to learn, they need to be nourished. The brain needs energy to be able to work. And students in any setting, whether it be in elementary, middle school, high school, or even college age, they need food or else it makes it very difficult for them to learn.
That was Dr. Susan Arendt from the College of Human Sciences at ISU. Other studies have shown that students who eat breakfast at school achieved 17.5% higher scores on standardized math tests and have better school attendance rates. Mirroring the concern of teachers in Boone, a recent study reports that teachers spend on average $37 a month buying food for hungry students, and that number has been increasing. One other question that comes up is why parents do not maintain sufficient balances in their children's meal accounts. Do they forget, or are they actually unable to add money to their children's accounts due to financial circumstances? Dr. Arendt said that there is no real data on that, nor on whether these new policies have the intended result of reducing deficit lunch accounts and keeping students fed. According to data from No Kid Hungry, 3/4 of the country's teachers report having students who routinely show up to school hungry. So the bottom line is that children in many cases rely on schools for their nutritional needs, and schools are in a position of finding a way to meet those needs. As community member Karen Sorensen noted, this requires some creative solutions to prevent children from being the victims, going hungry, and having their learning negatively impacted. I keep thinking back to my lunchtime in my first teaching job in Montana and reflecting on what we seem to have lost in terms of community and taking care of each other, even here in small towns in Iowa.
You have been listening to an interview done by Gail Seiler, primarily with Karen Sorensen, a parent in Boone, about the school lunch program in Boone Community Schools. Our next guest will be Pat Schlarbaum, who's a regular environmental producer for our local talk, who'll be talking about the pileated woodpecker.
Phenology is chronicling nature's happenings when they occur. The first hepatica of spring or the last osprey of autumn are kept in a journal for future reference. Today's focus on phenology are the pileated woodpeckers in Iowa. They're Iowa's largest and most conspicuous woodpecker. Nothing about its behavior is secretive. Its appearance and vocalizations are obvious. This crow-sized woodpecker is the original Woody Woodpecker character of the woods. Its feathers are mostly black with a red crest on their head with white streaking. Because of this, breeding territories are easily found and changes in its range within the state are easily tracked. Its range in Iowa was reduced after European settlement by logging and land clearing, but the species has recovered to some extent with the regrowth of some woodlands. Far northeastern Iowa woodlands have been the stronghold of their breeding range, and since the 1990s, this bird was first noted as a nester in Ledges State Park. Its loud vocalizations are unmistakable to any other bird. As a nester in Ledges State Park, just west of Ames, on the Des Moines River. Its western and southern movement of nesting range is a positive indication of this bird's place in Iowa's nesting birds. Essentially, any large timber tracts of a few hundred acres can host these impressive woodpeckers. And it winters throughout its breeding range, so watching for these birds in winter is exciting. In conjunction with its loud calls, its deliberate hammering on a dead tree or snag leaves tremendous piles of wood chips in its wake. The elongated holes in the dead tree are really quite lengthy. Shredded dead trees are a result of its foraging for grubs. Pileated woodpeckers are largely insectivores, meaning they go after insects and insect caterpillars. They forage by boring and gleaning and are especially fond of carpenter ants. They also eat fruit, nuts, and tree sap. So enjoy their jungle-like calls, and when these birds find an ant-infested tree, excavations are conspicuous to all central Iowa woodlands. And that's our phonology for today.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, the stories, and events in central Iowa. I've been your host, Jim Werbel. I started the show with Gary Guthrie, who talked about his missionary work, and is a follow-up from last Friday's show. Next, Gail Seiler interviewed Karen Sorensen and Susan Arndt regarding the school lunch program in Boone and efforts to change that. Finally, Pat Schlarbaum talked to us about the pileated woodpecker. Local Talk will be rebroadcast today at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you'll also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Again, that's khoifm.org. Like us on Facebook, get updates of all of our show postings in your news feeds. Local Talk was engineered today by Rick Morrison. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by L. Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Anonymous 4, English Lady Mass CD, The Gloria Section was also heard today. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, please. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible as a radio station. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to seeing you again on the radio.